You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you very much, Scott. Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Kelly Evans, and we're pretty much at session lows on the Dow right now. It's down 760 points, 2.2%. Similar decline for the S&P, and look at the NASDAQ. It's down almost 3% today, about 2.75%. We're going to dig into every aspect of this September swoon. A big reason for it seems to be the trouble over in China. One of the country's biggest real estate companies could collapse, markets fearing the potential shockwaves. But is this all part of China's intentional crackdown? We'll have all of it for you in just a moment. Let's first start with Dom Chu and the numbers today. Dom?
All right, so the numbers are, like you said, session lows right now for the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ composite. A lot of that weakness having to do with just a general risk aversion. It's not just what's happening in China. That sentiment is carrying over to just about every asset class out there. And like we said, 765 points for the Dow, pretty much session lows at this point here. If you take a look at some other parts that are feeling some of the reverberations, let's take a look at the flight to safety. One place people are starting to buy up is the U.S. government bond market, forcing prices higher and yields lower. A lot of the yield curve, various maturities within that Treasury spectrum, are all seeing their interest rates fall. One of these spreads that people are looking at right now is the difference between 30-year interest rates for U.S. government bonds and 5-year Treasury note yields. That is collapsing now down about 2%. The reason why it's important is if you see here, this is the lowest difference between the 5- and 30-year government bonds that it has been since the summer of last year. The reason why that's important is because that's going to affect the banking sector, specifically here in the United States. Take a look at that, because when these banks start to see that spread compress, they tend to go lower in stock price. Citigroup shares down 5% right now. Bank of America down 4%. JP Morgan Chase down 3.5%. And regional banks like KeyCorp down about 5% as well. Those interest rate differentials are huge with regard to the banks. Keep an eye on that trade. The second worst performing sector, by the way, financials in the S&P 500. Then look at the big technology stocks. Apple is down 2.5%. Microsoft 2.5%. Alphabet 2%. Amazon, Facebook, all of these stocks make up a large part of the U.S. market, that general risk aversion even hitting those mega cap technology names. And then one place to keep an eye on, utility stocks. They've been wavering between gains and losses ever so slightly. You can see just about flat on the session right now. The utilities trade has been an underperformer over the last couple of months. It did catch a little bit of a relative bid today compared to other parts of the market. But even then, Kelly, that utilities ETF currently is on an 8-day losing streak. We'll see if it can break that today. We'll send things back over to you.
Yeah, again, defensive sectors holding up, except that one. And there's such so many other stories going on in the energy and utility space right now. Dom, we appreciate it. Dow's down 770 points. And as stocks sink and are on track for their worst month in over a year, is it too late to make changes to your portfolio? Joining us now is Eli Saltzman. He's portfolio manager of the Neuberger Berman Large Cap Value Fund. Eli, let's pick up on what Dom was just describing. Your top holdings include JP Morgan, Bank of America, PNC, Truist. So you see that flatter curve and you must be, you know, we've seen this environment before, but do you think today's just a head fake?
Yeah, I think today is a head fake. I mean, there's some very serious news. There's a lot of fear that this is a Lehman Brothers contagion type moment. We do not believe that to be the case at all. Financials are selling off as a result. The yield curve is flattening. We expect later this year the yield curve to steepen. As most of you recall, about 4 weeks ago, I said on CNBC that I thought the next 4 to 6 weeks is going to be choppy. I think now we're down to the final 2 weeks. I think this is the last opportunity to take advantage by the cyclicals and specifically by the financials. Take advantage of this head fake.
So we have the S&P not quite down 5%, and you're telling me it's over. This is like the first 5% correction we've had in over a year. What is it, because of corporate buybacks, the huge retail participation in the market? Is it the fact that everybody's been anticipating this decline so it scares nobody? I mean, what gives you the confidence to say this is going to be just a pretty short-lived event?
Yeah. I'm not saying today is the last day. I'm saying over the next 2 weeks is what I believe it's going to be short-lived. I'm expecting that at some point in the next 2 weeks for the China government to step in and frankly stop the contagion. So the yield curve flattening should stop and it should actually start to steepen again. And it's the last chance to buy the cyclicals. If you look at the cyclical side of the market's actually been quite weak for the last several months. While the overall indices have held up, the cyclical side of the market has actually not been a particularly good place to be over the last 3-4 months. I think the correction is getting very long in the tooth, and I think this is the final 2 weeks.
So I'm glad you put it in that context, because it has been a tough stretch for cyclicals. You say, I want to make sure everybody caught this, you think this is the last chance to buy them before they start to take off again and run away with things. Tell me about what would have to work for that to happen. Do interest rates have to rise? Do commodity prices have to resume their increase? And is all of this going to happen because you fundamentally think China's going to stop this crackdown and start pushing its economy back towards expansion again?
Sure. I mean, listen, let's talk definitionally for a sec. So first of all, for value or cyclicals to work, you need an accelerating economic environment. We think the economy is on the verge of reaccelerating as we get through Delta COVID, which we think is peaking as we speak, and as China reverses some of the policy stance they've taken that have caused some of these real estate issues, we think that you're looking at an environment where 3 or 4 months from now, you're going to be looking at a much healthier or rosier view of the economy than we're looking at today.
But Eli, why, and I know you're not a China specialist here, but I'm curious why you think they would stop a crackdown that seems to be accelerating and gathering force. They've known, the authorities themselves, about these problems with Evergrande for months, right? They had ample opportunity to stop it before it got to this point. It seems instead like they are literally shepherding it to this point. Maybe they'll figure out how to mop up the mess so it doesn't affect the people in the wealth management products or those who put down property down payments. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be on the side of this that is allowing it to proceed, not the side that would lean against and stop the clock. Although, again, Jim Chanos warned us last hour, we've seen this story 4 times in the past decade, and each time they've gone back to a property-fueled expansion, and maybe they will this time around.
Yeah, I don't think they can risk the contagion. You know, right now, from what we hear, there's about 4 or 5 other real estate companies that are feeling the contagion right now, as well as some of the banks. They can't afford to, you know, as we go into 2022, they have the Olympics, they have their elections. They can't afford for this to spread and become a contagion. They need to stop this, and they need to stop this now.
They may need to stop it now. Final question on this. But if people are saying this whole property companies, again, these were some of the biggest companies in the world, if you go back a few, certainly the biggest property developers, they're saying they're too big to fail. They will get bailed out by the government and so forth. Those are not comments that China's leadership wants to see. They've gone after every big tech company, every prominent billionaire. Celebrities are getting scrubbed from movies they appeared in who are some of the biggest fan favorites that China's had for the past decade. Why would they stop short of continuing a crackdown on a property sector that would seem to have more power than any other sector they've so far clamped down on?
Yeah, listen, I'm not saying that Evergrande is not going to go away here. I'm not saying that the China government isn't going to figure out a way to, quote unquote, buy the assets of Evergrande at a very discount price. And it might actually hurt people like the shareholders, but they can't afford to let a contagion happen here. They can't afford for it to spread to the banks and then affect the entire economy. They need to stop this. It might hurt Evergrande, but they can't let it hurt the economy.
Well, and I really appreciate you sort of elaborating on these theses as we're watching the market continue to slide. The Dow's down more than 800 points right now. And, you know, as somebody who's probably been through a number of these cycles yourself, you've said this is the last opportunity to buy cyclicals. You have a large cap value fund that has huge holdings in financials and consumer staples, cyclicals, if you want to call it that, even Pfizer, Aon companies of that ilk. So if you could just explain why you think the next phase of leadership will be companies in this part of the market, not big cap tech, right? Not innovative, developing economies, not the new stay at home, the new economy plays that people have been telling us about time and again that are going to lead the way out. A lot of these kind of are a snapshot of what the world looked like going into the pandemic.
Yeah. I have a couple of reasons. One is the consumer is incredibly healthy and reliquified. Two is CapEx levels have not been this low in the last 30 years. And then three is inventory levels have not been this low in about 50 years. Sorry, CapEx really since the financial crisis. There was one other period where it has been this low. So you're going to get a rebuilding on the CapEx side. You're going to get a rebuilding on the inventory side. You got a very healthy consumer. And as Delta COVID moves on here, you're going to get a reaccelerating economy, which is definitely going to be better for the cyclicals over the non-cyclicals, which includes big tech.
Quick final comment. Do you think that China is the key to the accelerating phase coming out of this correction that you're anticipating? Or should I be asking you about the debt ceiling? Should I be asking about, you know, the litany of other things that could be contributing to a market sell-off?
I think the two most important factors here for the next 3 months is China reversing policy and not letting this become a contagion and Delta COVID getting past us. I personally believe that Delta COVID is the last major COVID wave. And if this last major COVID wave does start to decelerate, cases come down, hospitalizations come down, we're already seeing that move. We're seeing it on a second derivative basis. That in combination with China reversing policy, you will see a massive cyclical move in this market.
All right. Eli, thanks for all your time today. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Eli Saltzman of Neuberger Berman. With the Dow sliding almost 850 points this afternoon, we turn to Mike Santoli. Mike, because often the trading behavior, even intraday, can give us some information about market positioning.
Well, absolutely, Kelly, about market positioning. And it looks like a very broad step back in equity exposures. It's not really applying just to things that are directly in the orbit of China, the property sector, any deleveraging over there. You did see on a somewhat tactical basis a few levels on the S&P 500 that people thought might be a good place for some traction. Didn't really hold. We're now still working on this, 5% pullback roughly from the all-time highs. Just about there, I would say, just a few more points. And I think that's part of it. I mean, we have this spillover effect often. After the September options expiration, you have basically people leaning in one direction. Without getting into the mechanics of it, there was the open possibility that there would be a little bit of a cascade because you have some people who, I mean, think about it, right? There's a certain number of traders who are involved on the long side because nothing gets this market down. We haven't had anything more than a 3% pullback. When that no longer applies, maybe you have to kind of widen out your band for what you'd be willing to accept on the downside.
Mike, corrections have been so rare that people, do you think they'll be more willing to jump at the first opportunity? How do you think the dynamic might be different now than even it was 12 months ago, which is basically the last time we had a 5% correction?
Yeah, it's tough to read because there is a lot of house money built up, you would say, in portfolios. Equity exposures came into the summer, really, at high levels. So in other words, nobody has to buy to really get their equity allocations where they want them to be. On the other hand, I can also view what's happening today as the biggest stocks, particularly the Nasdaq stocks, catching down to a lot of what else was going on in the market already. The average S&P stock came in today 11% off its high. Nasdaq, small cap stocks even worse than that. So in a sense, it's a little bit of this corrective action that's come for the indexes belatedly.
And if we could zoom out a second, how would you compare the action in equities? Dom mentioned the flattening yield curve right off the top.
Yeah.
We've got the commodities complex where things seem to be going the wrong ways. You have energy inputs that most consumers and businesses rely on, generally heading to the upside, especially overseas. Meanwhile, you have the more cyclically sensitive ones moving down, and then that's crushing the cyclical names today.
Right. I think it all fits together. If I looked at even the sub-industries in the S&P 500, it all makes a lot of sense. Trucking's not down very much today. The airlines are actually holding up. It's a lot more the global reflation, cyclical type stuff that is pulling back along with financials and those big techs, which had just outperformed by too much coming into September, I think, to withstand this kind of selling. It doesn't feel like a buying panic in treasuries today. Yes, the yields are down, curve is flattening, but it hardly seems like something that is forced buying of safer assets. It definitely is more just adjustments around the edges. Watching credit spreads, too, definitely softening up, widening out, but it's, again, not something that says things are really in dire straits, at least not yet. We also have, by the way, the Asian markets closed. It's a holiday over there.
True.
The Fed meeting. There's all kinds of reasons not to try to be a hero just in this particular day.
And I thought it was significant that Jim Chanos, who's been short China for basically a decade, said he does not view what's happening with the property sector there as something that's systemic to Western financial markets. At the same time, he thinks it's a terrible investment. Yes, he's been short side for a long time. Yeah. But his point is the Chinese stock market has underperformed for 12 years, the only one of the major markets, even while the economy has grown. Now you have the Wall Street Journal coming out with these pieces about how they're continuing to press ahead with a country that's going to look more socialist, that has common prosperity, that has even less interest maybe in the success of the capitalist market-driven model. Mike, so here's my question. What is the impact, the ripple effect for U.S. investors? If China's economy slows, if the stocks continue to struggle, how much of a correlation is there right now? And look at what the hedge funds already got wiped out earlier this year.
Right. I mean, arguably, our capital markets have rarely in the last few years been less entwined with what's going on with domestic Chinese markets. Look, if the domestic Chinese economy slows, it's a tremendous consumer of stuff. Obviously, it's a big contributor to global growth, but I don't think it's decisive. It's not something that most S&P 500 earnings was really hinged on. But, this market has ignored a lot of these potential threats all along. We're up 20% going into September. It's not like the U.S. stock market kind of owes you anything to kind of have, a complete neglect of things going on overseas. I just do think that between the seasonal effects, a lot of the technical stuff, and the fact that earnings forecasts are flattening out for U.S. companies just because of where we are in the cycle, I think it makes sense that that you're getting a little bit of a pinch here in our market.
All right, Mike, we appreciate it. We'll let you go for the time being. Mike Santoli watching things for us down at the NYSE. As the sell-off accelerates, let's turn to Julia Borson, who's got a check on the social media movers today as well for us. Julia?
Yeah, Kelly, take a look at these social media stocks. They are down more than the broader market. Snap down about 4%. Spotify, Pinterest, both down over 4%. Twitter and Facebook both down about 3.5%. And I just want to point out one rare stock that is trading pretty much close to the flat line. That is Verizon. Verizon was up in the green earlier today. Now it's down just fractionally. And this is on news out Friday afternoon about Verizon sweetening its subsidies for the iPhone to match competitors. So that is a rare stock that's not down too much, but those social media players all down more than 3%. Kelly, back over to you.
And again, Julie, I think you could try to sort of draw the line from China's crackdown to U.S. social media names, or you could just say, nah, they're just down.
Well, Kelly, you know, we have to remember that Facebook does not operate in China. So these are, in many ways, these companies have been restricted. Yes, you can access them if you have a VPN or things like that. But these are not, you know, these social names in particular, it's not like the Hollywood studios that increasingly are relying on China for box office revenue. You know, Facebook is a little bit of an unusual situation there in terms of its limits on its ability to operate.
No, absolutely. And I think it gives a broader sense of what's going on than just the kind of oversimplified narrative, if you want to call it that, of the issues in the China's property sector. We appreciate it, Julia. Thank you. Julia Borson with a look at some of the other big droppers today. We also want to check the vaccine names as we go out. Should have been some big positive news. Pfizer saying its COVID vaccine is safe and generates a robust immune response in kids ages 5 to 11 today. The company, along with BioNTech, tested a two-dose regimen of about 10 micrograms. That's a third the dosage used for teens and adults. And Pfizer said it plans to submit the data to the FDA as soon as possible. Now, shares of Pfizer at last check were slightly higher on this session. Again, now they've turned negative by about 0.1%. So not getting a huge boost on this news. Maybe it's just priced in. They're also up 20% year to date. BioNTech lower after a 329% run so far this year. Moderna flat today, up 309% since January. Let's bring in Peter Buchvar now. He's got a look at the economic landscape for us. He's with Bleakley Advisory Group and a CNBC contributor. And Bleakley, Peter, is not, you know, a point of view here, we should emphasize. It just so happens that things don't look that great today, do they?
Absolutely. We want asset prices to rise, not fall.
Yeah. So explain how you think the linkages to today's sell-off work. Is it emanating from China? Are those concerns legitimate? Do you agree with Jim Chanos that it shouldn't have a big effect here? And if so, is it other concerns, just simply market positioning, seasonals, the debt ceiling, et cetera?
Well, first thing, you know, China is a big deal, but as Jim said, possibly just for China. But I don't think it's a coincidence that this is happening right before the Fed is about to taper its asset purchases. The ECB is trimming back on their QE. The Bank of England may mention and start the same on Thursday, and that when that liquidity spigot, even if it just stops not in terms of continuing to flow, but isn't increasing anymore, that I think is a reason to have a gut check on risk. I do think that for investors in the U.S., when they see credit spreads as tight as they are, when they see valuations as high as they are, that what is going on in China could be just a reason to rethink paying below 4% for a high yield bond, receiving 6% for a triple C bond, which is one grade over default, and that this is a perfect reason for people to start paying attention to valuations and the prices they're paying.
Fair enough, Peter, although it's going to be hard to tell what the quote-unquote right price should be when we can't even figure out what the right price for the benchmark treasuries is. You know, that yield moves around with fundamentals, but the level seems to be divorced from any economic reality, unless you would say that we are in a kind of, you know, stagnant growth period for quite some time here in the U.S., and maybe we are. Obviously, if you lose Chinese growth at the margin, that's not going to help anybody.
Absolutely. I think growth concerns are the reason why the 10-year is at 130 and not higher in light of the inflation stats. But there's also growth concerns in the U.S. as we have potentially, you know, fiscal hangover coming next year, considering that a lot of the money that was spent this year may not be repeated, particularly the government transfer payments that was able to sustain consumer spending. And then I've been of the belief that inflation itself is slowing growth, in that we are in this sort of stagflationary type of environment. And I'm not aware of a time in history when a stagflationary environment leads to higher multiples, usually leads to lower multiples.
Okay, fair enough. But do you think it's going to persist into 2022? So we're starting to see, especially in Europe, big, big problems in terms of the government having to help out households with the cost of energy bills. This could get worse, obviously, before it gets better. And then does the issue just go away come 2022?
I think sticky, persistent inflation is going to remain with us for the next couple of years. As supply side issues aren't quickly cured, maybe we've topped out in terms of the rate of change in inflation, but we have to remember that all we need to do is go to an inflation rate of 3 to 4% to create its own challenges. I mean, a world of zero interest rates, negative interest rates, tight credit spreads, high debt levels, high equity valuations around the world, that's not a good backdrop when if inflation just slows to 3 to 4%. And I don't see us going back to a world of inflation of 1.5 to 2 for a few years to come.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about positioning. We spoke with Neuberger Berman off the top, who in their large cap value fund obviously is positioned in a lot of banks, cyclicals, thinks that's the next leg of this trade. Do you agree with that?
The cyclicals that I'm most comfortable with is will be beneficiaries of the inflation story, which, yeah, it's going to get dinged in the short term with what's going on in China. But I think that the demand relative to the supply for energy is going to be remaining off balance. I think agriculture is still a good area to be in as the global demand for food is not going to stop regardless of what's going to happen in China. And I even think precious metals. But overall in a portfolio, people have to just lower their expectations for returns over the next couple of years, especially if with inflation now sticky, sort of tying the hands of central banks, and if we're about to embark on a tightening cycle, because I do believe tapering is tightening, that's a different backdrop than what we've seen over the last couple of years.
Sure. Mohammed Al-Erian referenced
putting aside COVID.
Oh, absolutely. The question I sort of want to pivot you to is whether China is uninvestable, which is something that Mohammed Al-Erian suggested this morning, that Jim Chanos, as I mentioned, was kind of talking about last hour. Peter, do you think China is uninvestable? And if so, is it just for the near term, the near couple of months until this leadership, you know, this big party Congress happens next year and Xi Jinping is reelected, using air quotes, to a third year term? You know, is a lot of this just preparing the way for the Chinese sort of big gathering next year in which that's likely to happen, and then growth kind of takes off again, or not? What do you think is going to happen there? Because this is one of the most important asset classes to a ton of U.S. investors. Growth, obviously, even more so, but even the investment aspect.
I think from a macroeconomic perspective, China is a powerhouse that will only grow in presence when you look out over the next 10 to 20 years. And yes, they got to overcome these excessive debt levels and bankruptcies, but they seemingly willing to tolerate. But I don't think it's investable, but you have to be careful. I mean, I think investing in maybe a Hong Kong company that is not under a VIE structure, that's benefiting from the growth in China, is investable. I mean, China's not going to crack down on pharma. They're not going to crack down on healthcare. They're not going to crack down on certain areas of consumer spend, consumer discretionary. I mean, the parts of and the Chinese economy that they're not going to. And a lot of the things that they're doing is not much different than we're doing here. I mean, 20 years ago, we tried to break up Microsoft, and we're banging the heads of all the internet companies that we're seeing. So I think that China's hard-handed fist is what is causing a lot of angst. But I think if people take a step back, their approach to regulation is not much different than what we've seen in Europe and the U.S.
I think the final question that Chanos raised was a tactical one, saying that U.S. investors, when they think they own something in China, even if it's pharma or consumer discretionary, where you say you might feel more comfortable having exposure, that you're not really owning the underlying. The Chinese authorities don't recognize that. Gary Gensler is somewhat concerned about that. Does he have a point?
He's absolutely right. But I think that there are ways of playing China without owning some of those stocks. I mean, you can buy stocks in Singapore that's going to benefit from the Chinese consumer. The Chinese consumer, I argue, will be the most important economic growth driver looking out over the next 10 to 20 years, just as the U.S. consumer was over the prior 20 years. So there are many ways of playing the Chinese consumer without necessarily owning a Chinese stock.
Fair enough. And I'm sure there's some U.S. names as well that could, quite simply, they get their exposure there. You don't have to deal with all the hoops and hurdles. Peter, thanks for your time today. Yeah.
Thanks, Kelly.
Peter Buchvar with Bleakley Advisory Group. Let's get a quick check on the markets. Just off session lows, but still down almost 800 points for the Dow. It's 2.3%, exact same pretty much for the Dow and S&P. Those declines, Nasdaq down 2.7%. Energy, financials, and consumer discretionary are all the worst performers today. Energy is down nearly 4%. A quick check on oil right now, as I mentioned, will also show some of the red across the screen there. WTI crude heading back down towards 70 a barrel, just about halfway above that mark right now. It's nearly a 2% decline. The 10-year yield also moving lower. We got a whole lot more on the other side of this break on the sell-off, including a look at the tech laggards, the travel stocks, and how home builders are reacting, especially after some positive news in the morning. We're back in a moment. Welcome back, everybody. The markets are near session lows, at which point the Dow is down 843. We're down 761 right now. That's 2.2%. The Nasdaq, the underperformer, it's down about 2.7%. Let's check on some of the biggest movers. That's energy, the biggest laggard in the S&P today. No longer the best performing sector this year, even. It's been replaced by real estate. Devon, Occidental, Diamondback Energy, all down about 6 to 7% right now. And the chip makers are also seeing losses. Makes sense. Both of these are cyclically sensitive parts of the market. VanEck Semiconductor ETF down 3%. Some of the individual names about 4.5%. They're also on track to snap a 4-month winning streak with their worst month since March of 2020. Airlines are bucking the trend as the U.S. plans to ease travel restrictions for foreign visitors who are vaccinated against COVID. American Airlines squeezing out a 1.3% gain. That makes it the best performer in the S&P right now. Let's move along, check on some of the home builders. Diana Olick here with a look at how they're trading today after some positive reports this morning, Di.
Yeah, we thought so, Kelly. Yeah, home builders getting creamed with a name like Lennar, D.R. Horton, and Pulte, all down 3 to 4% on the day. We did get home builder sentiment this morning. It was actually up for the first time in 3 months, with builders citing the drop in lumber prices. But then we got this surprise this morning from D.R. Horton, giving some guidance, warning on Q4 revenues, citing continued significant disruptions in the supply chain, including shortages and delivery delays in certain building materials, along with tightness in the labor market. They slashed revenue guidance due to lower outlook in closings. We got similar guidance from Pulte just a few weeks ago, and we will be getting quarterly earnings from Lennar after the bell today. Kelly?
You know, Diana, we should take a second since we have you as our expert here. What's going on in China is basically a giant question about their property sector. And in China, they've been, this is not a new story. This is a very, very old story. They have had a version of kind of our 06 house price situation for years and years now. They've had home prices appreciating, the government trying to figure out what to do about affordability and trying to figure out how to crack down without then negatively impacting people who might be on the other side of that. So I just don't know if you want to offer any sort of commentary on those who look at the U.S. and say, well, wait a minute, we're going to end up in a similar position the way that home price acceleration is going.
Well, I do think we do have that home price acceleration that you're talking about. Double-digit gains, prices for new and existing homes up over 18% year over year. Some call that a bubble. But you have to remember, we have very strict underwriting. This is nothing like 2006. I'm not an expert on how Chinese mortgages work, but I do know that the underwriting on the loans today are very strict, meaning you have to have a lot of skin in the game on your home. So even if prices were to pull back slightly in the market, so many people have so much equity in their homes. In fact, $1 trillion in equity was added just in the second quarter of this year due to high home prices. So there's a huge cushion for homeowners in the U.S. to fall back on should prices ease up. I don't think anybody expects nationally for U.S. home prices to fall. You could see some local markets that weaken. You could certainly see the home price gains shrink. We definitely expect that, and we're seeing that already. But again, I don't think the U.S. is in that sort of situation now.
That's a very interesting point, just how much wealth is now tied up in the household sector. Diana, thanks. We'll check back in soon. Our Diana Olick in Washington, D.C. today. Now to Josh Lipton over at the Nasdaq, checking on the tech stocks. Some of the biggest decliners today, Josh.
So, Kelly, let's dig right into some of those big movers. We'll start with Apple, which is in the red here. Some actually positive commentary from some on the street this morning about their early iPhone 13 checks, but that is not helping in today's trade. Apple is now down about 10% from its 52-week high. Same with Amazon. If you have a look at that name, also about 10% off its 52-week high as well. Just barely now in the green so far in 2021. FANG members all down more than 2%. Semis also worth looking at. The SMH, the ETF that tracks the chips on track here for its worst day since May. Under the hood of that ETF, NVIDIA, Applied Materials, both down hard, though both up strongly still in 2021. Kelly, back to you.
All right, Josh, thank you. Our Josh Lipton today. We're continuing to watch a big market sell-off with Chinese internet's the worst performer on the NASDAQ 100 today. Also, the cryptos are getting crushed. Bitcoin and Ether down about 7%. Bitcoin hitting its lowest level since early August. We'll tell you why some in that community are concerned about the developments in China. Big tech also falling today. Amazon, Facebook, Google lower, like Josh was just discussing, even though they have little or no exposure to China's economy or debt. Does that make now a good time to buy? We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. The market sell-off continues this hour as fears over the health of China's property and real estate sector continue to spook global markets. Names with high exposure taking the brunt of this move. Caterpillar, which gets about 5 to 10% of its sales in China, on pace for its worst day since last November. It's down more than 5%. Commodities tied to China's growth story are lower as well. Iron ore continuing to drop, down another about 5, 6%, call it. This was after already seeing its worst week since the financial crisis. China, of course, is the top buyer of steel. The SLX steel and mining ETF also down about 5% today. For more on what's playing out in China and whether there are any opportunities, let's bring in Nancy Tangler. She's Chief Investment Officer at Laffer Tangler Investments. Our very own Seema Modi is here as well. Seema, can you just kick things off with sort of the latest day of play? What are you hearing in China? I guess the biggest question for global markets is whether authorities will intervene to prevent Evergrande from defaulting or from that situation from getting worse or not.
Yeah, you got to wonder. China doesn't like a black eye. So if that's the case, why they haven't stepped in yet. But in the meantime, I think markets are trying to understand what the direct implications of this Evergrande story really is. If you look at what is actually moving today, the global mining and steel stocks, I mean, this is a country that just in the last 10 to 12 months has spent billions of dollars on copper, iron ore, metal, steel. And so this idea that it could get its economy out of this pandemic-induced downturn by funding a number of these infrastructure projects. So if you have the property sector, which makes up about 25% of China's GDP, start to slow down, how does that impact the prices of these major commodities when you have China being such a big player?
And Nancy, we've been for months covering this story now in China. It started with Alibaba, arguably last fall. Then you had the issues with Didi, their IPO here. We've seen them crack down on everything from after-school tutoring to video games, which can only be played 3 hours a week. Arguably, to Seema's point now, this property crackdown could be part of that. So do you sit back and wait for the end of this story, or do you see any opportunities as an investor?
No, Kelly, I think you definitely have to sit back. I mean, every investor knows that stocks are a claim on assets, and now you have the Chinese government in competing with you in a somewhat unpredictable manner. And so I think from their standpoint, it's entirely calculated and well thought out. They're worried about the demographics that they face going forward. And so this is an attempt, a long line of attempts to get the middle class into a place where things are more affordable and they can have more children. And we really saw it with the for-profit school crackdown, and then, of course, all the ancillary aspects that you already mentioned. So I think investors need to be wary because you don't know who's next. And we also don't know what's going to happen with the currency. And so I think there are better places to be invested, frankly, and I wouldn't get near China for now and sometime.
And does that then, Nancy, include U.S. investments that might have big exposure there? In other words, do you have to literally kind of go through companies in every sector and try to filter out the ones that might have big exposure to the economy there for the time being or not?
No, I think you definitely have to do that. You're spot on. We've been running our portfolio's revenue against what the percent of the revenue is that comes out of China. Our portfolios are well below 10%. I think you have to be wary of the targets. So, you know, the government may react differently to chip providers because they simply have to tolerate U.S. providers. But that doesn't mean they have to make Nike products available, for example. So I think you have to really dig in, sharpen your pencil, and look at where you're getting revenue from your multinational holdings and whether or not you know, educate the guests, you think those revenues are safe.
Yeah. And again, just reiterate, make sure everyone understood you there. You're saying you're looking for maybe less than 10% revenue exposure for a lot of your companies now to China. Sima, we appreciate it. Nancy, if you'll stick around, we want to talk some crypto before we let you go as well. The argument for Bitcoin being a safe haven losing some ground today. It's down more than 7% to below 44,000, its lowest level in about 2 months. Other cryptos in the red as well. Ether's down 7%. Ripple's down 12%. Kate Rooney's here with more. Kate, I see a lot of discussion online in the crypto space. People kind of concerned about the ripple effects from China here.
Yeah, Kelly, that's right. You mentioned the safe haven argument. That's looking further and further away. That's not the case today, at least in this week. And any of the big sell-offs in equity markets we've seen over the past couple of years really tend to result in collateral damage in the crypto market. So it's a dynamic we've seen play out before. Traders and analysts I've been talking to say what happens here is they kind of sell out of those high growth tech names. FinTech is getting hit today, too. So that's one dynamic. And Bitcoin is really still categorized as more of a growth play versus any sort of hedge against inflation or some sort of safe haven asset. You look at gold, meanwhile, that's been up today. But a lot of traders need liquidity in times like this, so they might need to meet margin calls, for example. And the Evergrande dynamic, Bitcoin in particular, really is a global asset. So any fears overseas tend to really, really hit the crypto markets, especially out of Asia, where a lot of the activity, the majority of activity in some of the crypto markets tends to happen out of Asia.
But is there any direct connection, Kate? You know, some there have been some rumors here and there between Evergrande and the crypto market.
So Tether at least came out pretty early on and said, we don't have any exposure. They are backed by majority commercial paper. They said, we are not tied. We don't have anything, any of our assets backed by Evergrande. So they came out early because there was a lot of speculation. But we've seen this in the stablecoin or at least DeFi market. There is a lot of fear out there that there is some sort of overlap that, you know, despite the name stablecoin, it really is linked to things that could potentially be risky. There's not as much disclosure as some folks would want. But that's something that, you know, Gary Gensler, for example, is paying a ton of attention to. And the whole DeFi market, you know, Bitcoin is one thing and is seen in the crypto markets as at least more stable. You know, there's a lot of other deviations and examples of things that aren't necessarily Bitcoin. They're sort of their own, you know, when you think of Ethereum or Solana, which has gotten a lot of attention lately. But Gary Gensler and the SEC are paying a ton of attention to this. And you had Coinbase today dropping a product that had hundreds of thousands of people on a wait list.
I was going to ask you, Kate, before you go. So Coinbase did announce this morning that I forget exactly the language I used, that they're abandoning the yield product after this very public spat with the SEC over it. Now, Coinbase argues other people are doing this. They're offering even higher yields. We wanted to play ball with the SEC, just kind of make sure everything was fine before we launched this. That did not go well for them. But I can imagine they might say, we're pulling our product from the market, but there are still many, many more out there.
There are. There's examples. You have companies like BlockFi and Celsius that have almost identical products that have already been launched. And Coinbase has said, you heard Brian Armstrong say that they couldn't really interact with the SEC. They said they were sort of blindsided by the idea that the SEC would come out and have some sort of enforcement action against them. So they said, you know, they're taking the more cautious approach. They're not going to launch a product that's potentially illegal. But BlockFi and Celsius are the examples that we've seen. There's been a couple of cease and desist letters out of sort of state regulators. So the question going forward, will the SEC take aim at some of the other companies that have already launched this with a good amount of success? I mean, they have products that they're not necessarily banking products, but they're high interest, you know, 8 to 9% interest on crypto. And the SEC, meanwhile, is wondering, wait a minute, that looks a little bit more like, I mean, either a bond or some sort of security. So I think there's a lot of attention on some of these lending products that don't really have, you know, there's no precedent. They're completely new products, so the SEC definitely paying attention.
Yeah, perhaps we could say that Coinbase shares are only down 4% today, Kate, when Bitcoin's down 7% and they face this high-profile setback. We appreciate it. Our Kate Rooney joining us today with the very latest. Let's get a quick check on markets. The Dow, as I mentioned, was down about 840 points at the lows of the session. We're down 766 right now. The Nasdaq down 2.5%. All of this today emanating about concerns about Chinese property giant Evergrande, which is said to be on the brink of collapse. The company is the world's most indebted property developer with about $300 billion worth of net debt, at least. Its bonds are included in a number of indexes across Asia. It indirectly creates more than 3 million jobs.
Evergrande warned investors twice in 2 weeks that it could default on its debts and also noted its property sales will likely continue to drop. The company is so big that some say the fallout could have ripple effects beyond China. So what could be next? Joining us now from Hong Kong is Mike Bird. He's Asia business and finance editor at The Economist. Mike, we really appreciate your time today. What would you tell us about, look, I guess maybe in some ways the question is, why has it taken the Chinese so long to crack down on Evergrande? This issue has been percolating for like 10 years.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. It's been a very, very long time. And I think the main issue has been a lot of Chinese growth has been generated by the property sector. This is 80% of Chinese household assets. It's a huge amount of economic activity, sort of a double-digit share of the Chinese economy. Evergrande is basically the most leveraged, aggressive player in this space, and it has been for a very long time. It's been able to chase a huge debt interest bill by essentially issuing more and more debt every year, taking on greater and greater liabilities from a number of sources, not just the bond market, not just banks, but its suppliers, its households purchasing homes from it, unbuilt homes, pre-sales, which are a huge part of the Chinese financing system for real estate. It's been able to outrun those debt interest costs basically until now. This is where the rubber hits the road, and it seems like it isn't able to do that any longer.
You know, if we go back to what Andrew Left warned about the company 10 years ago when it got him kicked out of trading in Hong Kong, he said that it's only held up. He argued it was insolvent then, and it was able to keep going thanks to junk bond sales and basically aid from the Chinese government. Why is it that this year, this moment, that has run out? It's not as if property prices have collapsed. This is not triggered by something falling on the asset side of the equation. So if we have Chinese cracking down on all these other sectors of their economy, I have to believe that maybe this is related, that they're drawing the line saying no more, and even this sector is not immune. And in that case, how can they mop this up and prevent it from causing harm to the Chinese people on the other side of the trade?
Well, I think you've got a feel for Andrew Left, for starters. He got a five-year cold shoulder order from the Hong Kong authorities. It was so long ago that he got the order that it expires next month. You know, he's going to be able to short Evergrande what's left of it in a month's time, and that's going to be fine. I think that what happened here is there's been a Chinese government policy. Now, the Chinese government's aware of the problems in the real estate sector and the property market in general. They brought in a policy called the three red line policy, mm-hmm. which is essentially real estate developers that didn't pass three financial metrics. They were on the wrong side of them. They wouldn't be able to issue net debt in the bond market. That's been the big problem for Evergrande. The Chinese government finally seems to be taking property sector leverage seriously. And when they take it seriously, the most leveraged player is not surprisingly the first to start a real sense of collapse. And as you rightly address, the real problem here is where does the line end? You know, is this just Evergrande? Is it just maybe a couple of other heavily leveraged players and the rest of the sector will be fine? Because when you start pulling a rug out from under this stuff, it starts to get difficult. One of the things that Chinese property developers do is they buy huge amounts of land from local governments, mm-hmm. right? Local governments rely on those land sales. It's their primary means of financing. So the local governments are inclined to jazz up, to you know, build up land prices as much as possible. They sell the land for as high a price as possible. The real estate developers then sell on the land at higher prices to their consumers, the people actually buying homes. This is a sort of vicious cycle that's fed in for years and years and years. And this is why things are so bad in terms of the property market cycle in China, why it's gotten to such a ridiculous extent. And it's what you see falling apart in front of you now.
And this goes back to last August when they started this three red line thing. So, again, not last month, but 13 months ago. And now it's really sort of picking up steam. The authorities are saying to the banks on the other side of this, don't expect them to be able to make certain payments. If they're, you know, I guess that makes us the biggest difference from Lehman is that in this case, the Chinese seem in some way to be shepherding this company into this this period that it's entering. I don't know quite what to call it yet. So for traders, for investors who have watched this crackdown more from one sector to the next, Mike, what comes next? You know, should we, if this was the biggest elephant in the room, if everybody said this is how the Chinese economy grows, you know, these property developers are too big to fail, is this the Chinese saying, you know, no, they're not? And if so, then what?
I mean, this is the really interesting question. So I would say that the direct financial linkages between Evergrande and between the major Chinese property developers in general and the rest of the global financial system are actually quite low. unless you own the bonds directly, and Evergrande's got a lot of US dollar bonds out there, but in terms of its overall leverage, most of it is Chinese. Unless you're directly exposed to that through the Chinese financial system, the Evergrande collapse probably won't mean that much to you. Mm-hmm. The real question is how this feeds through to real economic activity in China, right? 80% of household assets, you know what happens when home prices go up or down in the US, when they go up or down anywhere. It affects consumption activity. It affects behavior on the part of ordinary households. It affects everything. And the Chinese real economy has been such a source of economic growth globally for the last 10 years that pulling out, you know, just even a couple of percentage points of GDP, you can see where that knock-on comes through. You'll see European luxury companies affected. You'll see commodity producers affected. If it has a major economic impact, it will feed through those sort of real channels.
Yes.
Maybe the FX side, the commodities, companies with direct sales to China. It might not hit. It's not like a layman type event. It may not be systemic for the financial system globally, but you will feel this if it continues coming through the real economy.
Very well said. Mike, again, really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you for staying up for us.
Thanks very much.
Mike Bird with The Economist. Coming up, much more on the September swoon for the markets, with the S&P down nearly 4% from its highs, and all of that happening this month. Many reasons for the sell-off, but some are fingering the drama in D.C. How much is the debt ceiling debate weighing on stocks? We'll try to answer that right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. With the Dow down about 750 points today, the question many are asking themselves is, how big of a role are the events, or the lack thereof, in Washington playing in the sell-off? First, there's the debt ceiling. Then there's the matter of approving a budget. And a Wall Street Journal op-ed, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says failure to raise the debt ceiling could lead to, quote, widespread economic catastrophe. So how much are these gyrations in the nation's capital impacting markets? Let's ask Dan Clifton. He's head of policy research at Strategic Securities. Dan, it's great to have you. It's easy to dismiss these gyrations because we've seen them time and again. Is this time different?
Yeah, you know, Kelly, first, thank you for having me. And I would just argue, after 18 months of unlimited fiscal policy, unlimited monetary policy, the risks from Washington are increasing. That is, we're moving from a pandemic to an endemic. That means we got to withdraw some of the liquidity, both from a monetary and fiscal policy side. But in addition to that, in the short run, we're going to have to deal with a number of outstanding fiscal policy catalysts, of which none of them have a good answer for how they're going to get resolved. And so I just think it's adding to the uncertainty of other issues that are out there, like the economy slowing, issues in China. And now we know over the next 2 weeks, we're going to have to deal with these issues. We've been calling it the September to remember. Some of them really aren't big events, but the debt ceiling is starting to become a bigger event for investors, particularly in the short-term credit markets, as investors begin to demand more for holding short-term treasuries because of the uncertainty on how this is going to get resolved. And so at some point, Washington's going to have to put out a plan for how these issues are going to get resolved. And both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are digging in on the debt ceiling, which means that at the very least, we're going to have some political headline risk before this actually gets resolved.
What does it mean when you say you think there's a less than 50% chance the debt ceiling is raised by October 15th? And what do you think that means for markets in the meantime?
Yeah, look, we look at the X date. The X date for when the debt ceiling needs to be raised is probably going to be sometime in late October. I think what the market is starting to say is that it's probably not going to get resolved on September 30th when we got to deal with government shutdown and the expiring highway trust fund. But rather, you've got to let the pressure of that debt ceiling X date begin to really build in before the Democrats make a decision whether they're going to do this alone in reconciliation or whether the Republicans are going to join with them in doing it on a bipartisan basis. It's almost like you need the financial markets to pressure Congress to get to that point. Now, there are options for this to get done before October 15th. We posited today in our client note that if you take the bipartisan infrastructure deal, de-link it from that $3.5 trillion spending package and see if you can get Republican votes, not guaranteed, but it may be a way to be able to get some sort of resolution on the debt ceiling early. We just don't know. And so we're wondering, do the Democrats have a secret plan? Well, if they have a secret plan, we're probably going to have some chaos. And if they don't have a secret plan, then we're probably going to have chaos on steroids here. Either way, it looks like we're setting up for some sort of gridlock.
So if we either have chaos or chaos on steroids, then maybe we can understand why the markets are down. Dan, because you are so investor focused,
Yep.
How would you try to sift these issues sort of apart? If people say to you, okay, so what proportion of today's sell-off is China versus DC drama versus it's just, you know, seasonally weak time of the year? And which parts of the market do we want to avoid in the meantime? And are there any things we should pick up because they're offering us a one-time bargain opportunity right now?
Absolutely. So I think this is a 15% driven by Washington. People know that we're pivoting to these fiscal catalysts. At the same time, you have a slowdown and you have China issues building. But it's going to get louder. And I think that's the concern that folks have. So I would avoid short-term debt until we start to see resolution on these issues. And then, Kelly, to your point, that's going to create a huge buying opportunity. We are not going to default on our debt. It's very unlikely that we're going to do that. So it's really about this headline risk in the credit markets, particularly in the short-term credit markets, that we have to worry about. If for some reason we have a government shutdown, then you're also going to probably see highway trust fund money running out. That means that you would see people saying, okay, now it's going to be hard to raise the debt ceiling. I actually think it's going to be easier to raise the debt ceiling if we have a government shutdown. It create, when that legislation has to be produced to open up the government, they're probably going to have to attach a debt ceiling increase to it. They'll probably have to attach infrastructure financing to it. So if we ended up seeing weakness around these government shutdown or highway trust fund expiring, I think that creates a good buying opportunity. But this is as polarized as I've ever seen Washington. These issues are as big as I've ever seen on Washington. And it's finally starting to seep into the markets until we get some sort of resolution.
And I think we should go back to your first point, which is that, you know, fundamentally, we've changed from 18 months of stimulus spending to support the economy to a very different paradigm. You could argue it's a victim of its own success because of some of these inflationary pressures we're seeing as a result.
Absolutely, Kelly. And I would just argue that, you know, there are number of reasons why people say the economy is slowing. One of them is the Delta variant. The Delta variant has peaked. So technically, we should be getting a better economy here that comes from that.
Yeah.
The question is whether this fiscal drag that we're facing is actually also contributing to it. We did so much stimulus in the first half of this year that it boosted growth. It led to higher inflation.
Yeah.
And now that spending is beginning to roll off and roll off in a very meaningful way. None of which that $3.5 trillion package will replace in the short run. And so that's just another risk that's emanating here from Washington as that fiscal aid begins to roll off.
Ends at 59 on the dot, Dan Pro. Thank you very much, sir. Dan Clifton
Thanks,
of Strategus.
Kelly.
And that does it for us here on The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.